Welcome back to Shattering Myths. There's a news report out that a British medical student and a Frenchman, both of whom went to Syria last year, are now believed to have appeared in an Islamic State propaganda video showing the jihadists beheading Syrian soldiers and displaying the severed head of an American aid worker also. You know, nothing inspires a young Muslim to go out and play jihad more than beheadings. And evidently that's what the British medical student and Frenchman were involved doing. Ahmed Mutana told Britain's Daily Mail newspaper that his 20-year-old son, Nassar Mutana, appeared to be among the group of 16 jihadists seen in the video. You know, we ought to be concerned that you have a religion that is recruiting, successfully recruiting, Muslims are from around the world to join its fight by showing lurid pictures of decapitations, of auctions of sex slaves. It is astonishing that those kinds of images are found appealing. And then you have to say, what in the world is wrong with Islam that Muslims think that doing these things is somehow a service to their perverted God? And then at the same time, you have idiots like those in charge of the National Cathedral that are having what's called an Islamic scholar. Now, that's an oxymoron. You can't have any knowledge of Muhammad, the Quran, and of Islam and be a rational Muslim. It's just impossible. Muhammad was so perverted. Islam and the Quran are so ridiculous, so obviously false. There's just no concept. This idea of a Muslim scholar, which is what they wrote in the Washington Post. Front page, Washington Post, National Cathedral, a Muslim woman. And then on the inside, they had the ambassador from South Africa to the United States as a Muslim scholar giving the sermon, talking about how the world needs to stand together against the Islamic State because they have misappropriated Islam. And Washington Post, one of the largest newspapers in the world, considered one of the more credible newspapers in the world, a newspaper that has done wonderful work in the past, including the thing that I was talking about in the last segment of exposing the FBI for their malfeasance relative to the civil rights movement and Martin Luther King. And here, that is their lead story. And there's nobody with the Washington Post that has bothered to read the Quran and Hadith that has any clue about Islam. Because if they did, they would know that the Islamic State has not misappropriated Islam. They are the living embodiment of Muhammad's words and deeds brought forward from the 7th century to the 21st century. Same exact religion, practiced exactly the same way. And that the person who is lying is the imam who is claiming that the world's religion should stand against this corruption of Islam, and that the National Cathedral is turned into an absolute mockery on behalf of this deadly and destructive religion. You know, it's no different when we take somebody that's gone to West Africa's contracted Ebola, and we bring them back into the United States. When we invite Muslims to speak in places of religious authority in America, and then put their story, unfiltered, uncorrected, on the front pages of our newspapers. One of the great travesties in the world today is the slave trade. Muhammad built the religion of Islam on the slave trade. Had Muhammad not engaged in human trafficking, Islam wouldn't exist today. It was a huge part of the success of initially building Islam. Muhammad even says that he would not have been successful had it not been for Allah's willingness to support his engagement in slavery. In this statement, it's interesting that he attributes this to the aftermath of the Battle of Badr, where there are still rational people living in Yathrib, today's Medina, and they were opposing Muhammad because he ransacked a Meccan caravan with a group of armed thugs and kidnapped some individuals, slaughtered other individuals, tortured individuals, gloated over the killing, and robbed the caravan, and did so during the month of Ramadan, which was a pagan celebration at the time that he incorporated into his religion. And they were mocking him, saying, you know, this is a peaceful time. You should not have done that. Moreover, you know, it's immoral to take captives like this, to kidnap, to engage in the slave trade, to use to support your new religion through armed robbery. And Muhammad's response was that normally that would be the case, but with Allah, one of his prophets has made a great slaughter, that these other opportunities become available to him. And so Muhammad said, once a prophet makes a great slaughter in the land, and since the attack on the Meccan caravan was a sadistic slaughter of innocent life, Muhammad, by his God's testimony, was now empowered to engage in the slave trade. Now, the reason I tell you that story is that there are reports now from the BBC that nearly 36 million people worldwide, or one half of 1% of the world's population, live as slaves. The Walk Free, which is an anti-slavery campaign group, says that the Global Slavery Index, the GSI, says that India has the most slaves overall and that Mauritania has the highest percentage. While Islam is aggressive and has always been aggressive in the slave trade, the Hindu religion has a caste system. The Hindu religion with its caste system, very much like the Roman religion and the Greek religion, both had caste systems, and those on the lower rungs of the caste were essentially slaves. And this propensity of man to enslave his fellow man is something that's been with us for a very long time. And so we should not be surprised that in the world's largest or the world's second largest country by population, you would have the most slaves. That's not by percentage, but yet in India, the caste system is alive and well, and it's perverted. It's religious in nature, and it has caused the virtual enslavement of many people. The total is 20% higher this year, 2014, than it was for 2013, they say, mainly because of more refined methodology. The report defines slaves as people subject to forced labor, to debt bondage, to debt bondage would be the situation principally in India. Trafficking in humans, it is almost always the response of Islam. Now, sexual exploitation for money and forced or servile marriage exists both in India as a result of Hinduism and in Islam. It's probably equal in both countries where daughters are sold to men. Now, in Islam, it is repulsive. It is just absolutely savage what has occurred. And the very fact is that you have 250 million girls who have been bludgeoned by their mothers for this express purpose. That's the reason for the female genital mutilation, is to prove virginity of the daughter when she is sold. Essentially as a sex slave, when she's sold and compelled to marry a man. She has no rights. She has no say. She is owned by the man in Islam. She's sold by her parents. Very prevalent, widespread, despicable. No choice, no free will, no love, no freedom at all for the girl. And to a lesser degree, this also exists in Hinduism. It uses, this survey uses slavery in a modern sense of the term rather than as a reference to the broadly outlawed traditional practice where people were held in bondage and treated as another person's property. And yet that's what happens to women in Islam. Women are property in Islam. And so with 1.5 billion people, Muslims, half of them, the women, are essentially property. So the actual number here, if you wanted to look at those individuals who have no rights of their own, who are essentially owned, either owned by their parents or owned by their husbands, that are veritable slaves, you know, the actual number would probably be half of the female population of the Islamic population as a total, particularly in Islamic states where they're subject to Islamic law. So all of the women who are children in an Islamic country and who are forced into marriage in an Islamic country. So in the majority of Islamic countries, you'd have virtually every woman is a slave.
Well, yeah. What about Westerners who use revolving credit cards with compound interest?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of
slavery, in effect.
Yeah, yeah, and in the sense that they've gone in debt and they're now forced to work to pay off their debt. Of course, there's remedy in the West for our foolishness, our inability to live under our own means, and that is called the bankruptcy, where debts are forgiven. But it's to prevent economic slavery. I should have expressed this. It doesn't necessarily go without saying, but Mauritania has the highest percentage of slavery in the world. Well, there is no freedom of religion in Mauritania. The Constitution establishes the country as an Islamic republic and that decrees that Islam is the religion of all Mauritania's citizens. So it is resolutely Islamic, and being resolutely Islamic, it has the highest overall percentage of slavery. In fact, if you were to review this by percentage of population, you would find that while there are 17 million individuals that are considered living in slavery in South Asia, the 2.2 million in Middle East and North Africa would be a higher percentage of the overall population, and the 17 million in South Asia includes the largest Islamic population, which would be Indonesia and Malaysia, as well as there's a very significant Muslim population in India. And the way this particular map is drawn, Pakistan is considered part of South Asia. And in Pakistan, I think per capita, slavery is the second worst per capita in the in a country in Pakistan where Muslims represent 99% of the overall population. So, according to the report, the Pakistan and Uzbekistan are not only extraordinarily high in the number of slaves, but also amongst the highest in terms of percentage of the population that is held in slavery. And the reason with Islam is pretty straightforward. I can speak to you about Hinduism only in the sense that the caste system is very prevalent in that culture, and selling daughters to husbands is prevalent in that culture, both of which create the conditions for slavery. But in Islam, Sharia law endorses slavery. The Quran endorses slavery. Muhammad was a slave trader. So in Islam, slavery is considered good behavior, a religious behavior, holy behavior. And so long as Islam exists, human slavery is going to continue to be a problem. And now, the reason that slavery exists in Islam is not just because Muhammad was a slave trader. It's because Satan's influence on Islam is extreme. And Satan's single most desired state for humankind is the forfeiture of free will. And so when you have an Islamic country and there is no free will, when the religion is declared and imposed on people, when there's no discussion about religion, when any criticism of Islam is condemned as blasphemy and subject to death, that's Satan's ideal scenario, where half the population, women, are sold and have no rights. That's Satan's idea of nirvana. That's it's germane to the religion. And that's why it exists and is so prevalent in the world. If you want to rid the world of slavery, you'd have to first rid the world of Islam. Now, here's another story that is extraordinarily troubling. Typically, when I read these kind of stories from secondary sources, I shake my head and say, I don't know if this is true. This is pretty extreme, should it be true. But considering that this story is about Obama's disdain and threats to Israel, I think the likelihood of it being true is high enough for me to report it. This story reads, Obama took his jihad against the Jews to the next level. In a stunning reversal of fundamentally American foreign policy, Obama's threat implies that the United States is prepared to abandon Israel in the dock of the world body. The issue here is specifically the UN Security Council. Nothing happens at the UN of any great significance unless it is approved by the Security Council, of which the five permanent members can block approval. According to this article, it says the worst is yet to come. In a dramatic development, Israeli cabinet members are warning that the U.S. President Barack Hussein Obama threatened Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that the U.S. may opt out and not oppose any future hostile UN Security Council votes. That is, unless Israel acquiesces to American foreign policy demands, which means they would have to give up Jerusalem and the West Bank, which, in addition to having already given up Gaza, would do exactly what Yeshaya 17 says is going to happen, which is the thinning of Israel at the waist, making the country indefensible, at which time Muslims pour into Israel by the millions. And so that's basically what Obama is told Israel, that the United States is no longer going to block anti-Israel votes in the Security Council. And they're prevalent there. I mean, the UN has become nothing but a ploy for Islamic countries that wish to demonize Israel. You know, the Muslims act as terrorists, they assault Israelis, and the UN blames the Israelis. The Prime Minister told colleagues in recent days the Americans will not cast a veto against a resolution that reaches the Security Council. This is from Ariel Kahana, a diplomatic correspondent for NRG Dailies, and she told the a newspaper that that was the case Monday. The information was shared at a session of the Beit Yehudi, which is the Jewish Home Party. Beit is home. Yehudi is the, it's actually Yehuda, and Yehudim would be the place, Yehuda, the people, Yehudim, but corrupted to Yehudi in modern rabbinic-influenced Hebrew. That party is led by Economy Minister Bennett, and at a parting meeting with a number of members, including Ariel and Heber, the information was shared that Obama had threatened to withhold a United States veto. The threat, at least as leaked, implies the United States is prepared to abandon Israel in the dock of the world body, a step that could further destabilize relations between America and the United States. The Muslims, mocking the world as Palestinians, according to one version, are demanding that Israel pulls back to the pre-67 war lines by 2016, and that they will have their minions make that proposal at the United Nations Security Council, and that the United States won't block it. Now, if Israel were to pull back to pre-67 lines prior to the 6 Days War, Israel is thinned at the waist, just as Yeshaya 17 predicts. The country is indefensible, and Muslims will flood into the country exactly as the prophecy foretells. Now, I am convinced that that's going to happen. Yahweh has never missed in anything that he has ever said. Everything he has said is going to happen has happened. And so there is no reason to question that this will occur. But Yahweh says that the thinning of Israel follows the destruction of Damascus. Damascus has not yet been destroyed. The suburbs of Damascus have been destroyed, but the Syrian government, while it has fallen in terms of greater Syria, it still controls the city-state of Damascus, and the center of Damascus is still stands, not a twisted heap of rubble. So I suspect that the Abominator is going to have more difficulty with this than he may have anticipated. He may be a bit childish in the sense that he's demanding that Israel acquiesce to his demands, which are that they give up everything, which is makes them defenseless. But when they don't do it, which is they cannot do, he's really not in a position to withhold the U.S. veto. I think it's an idle threat. I think he would love to do it. I think he would do it if he thought he'd get by with it. I think he's not opposed to threatening Israel to get Israel to comply. But I do not see this occurring for at least another 5 to 10 years so that we move closer to the beginning of the tribulation when Damascus finally falls. And now, could Damascus fall over the next year or two? And could, therefore, the Abominator withhold America's support in the United Nations Security Council for Israel and put Israel in a position where it's Israel against the world prior to that time? Absolutely. But the sequence, while it involves the United States, and while the United States, according to Yeshayahu 18, is clearly hostile to Israel, and is clearly receiving a warning from Yahweh, and Yahweh despises America, this godless America muck is ridiculous. God hates America, and he makes us aware that he's warning America about its overall behavior. That's the purpose of Yeshayahu 18. And so this is another affirmation that God's projected statements regarding America are true, and that this is what we should expect from this administration and future administrations. The Palestinian Authority, according to the article, and UN Representative Mansour said on Friday that the main option is to go with a vote at the UN Security Council, knowing that the United States is now compromised. The PA officials said a day earlier that they have 7 out of the needed 9 yes votes in the 15-member Security Council, and the resolution can be, although the resolution can be vetoed by one of the 5 permanent members, which the United States is one. But if the United States doesn't veto it, you can be assured that that scummy little country known as the UK, that's there since they speak of Israel as a scummy little country, I'll turn the phrase on them, France, Russia, and China are unlikely to come to Israel's defense. So the United States is it in terms of the 5 permanent members, and the mythical people acting as Muslim terrorists say that they have 7 of the needed 9 yes votes among the rotating participants in the Security Council. What they haven't achieved through war, what they haven't achieved through terrorism, they will now seek to achieve through the UN. This is a president, according to this article, of very dangerous proportions, and is certainly an American threat. It's the most chilling thing that we in Israel have heard uttered in the decades of Israeli-U.S. relations. Quote, beyond the abandonment of Israel, it also flies in the face of previous agreements with the Americans, including the vis-a-vis Egyptian peace deal, in which the U.S. would hold the line against such maneuvers. When the United States forced Israel to give up the Sinai and give the Sinai back to Egypt, and when the UN, after the Six-Day War, compelled the Israelis to withdraw from Syria and to withdraw from Jordan, that the U.S. made many promises to Israel. One of those promises was that it would veto in the UN Security Council any such moves to weaken Israel. And yet America can't keep its word. America can't be trusted. And that's what this is all about, is that, you know, it'd be one thing for Israel just to go it on its own. But it's got the United States working behind the scenes against it, providing its enemies with 25 times more war material than we provide to Israel. 25-1. Agitating the world around Israel to make it ever more vulnerable. Dictating to Israel that it abandon huge swaths of land, and then telling Israel that unless it capitulates and gives up its security, then America will abandon it on the UN Security Council. It's a tragic but linear course of events that has America pretending to be Israel's ally while doing everything it can to undermine the country, which, again, is why Yahweh is so opposed, so negative towards, so hostile towards the United States of America. Moving slightly north, the Dateline here reads Beirut. We're talking about Lebanon, north of Israel. It reads that ethnic Kurds are, I don't know if there is anything other than an ethnic Kurd. When you're speaking of Kurds, Kurd, there is no Kurdish religion. There is no, if you speak of Kurds, it's a race. It's an ethnicity. So why don't we just call them Kurds? Kurds are helping members of the Islamic State in the battle for the key Syrian Kurdish town of Kobani, sharing their knowledge of the local terrain and language with the Islamic State, according to Iraqi and Kurdish officials. So here are Kurds now on both sides, and that's kind of what you would expect. First of all, everything I have heard from the Kurds, they can't be trusted. You know, they're the ones that say, you know, the sky is falling. You need to give us more weapons so we can keep the sky up, only to find out that the scenarios that they have outlined are untrue. We provide them with weapons, and then they don't use them effectively. We're in a battle with Turkey, which is a NATO ally, wanting to arm the Kurds to fight the Islamic State, when, in fact, Turkey has been fighting the Kurds for centuries. And that the Kurds provide the greatest terrorist threat of all to Turkey, and that Turkey and the Kurds have been at war with each other for a very long time, but now that the United States is aiding and arming the Kurds, we're making it worse. Welcome back to Saturday and Mist. To conclude this story, what we have learned is that there are many Iraqi Kurds that are fighting on behalf of the Islamic State. And that they're not only fighting on behalf of the Islamic State, but they're fighting ethnic Kurds, fellow Kurds, on behalf of the Islamic State. And you might wonder, you know, why would that happen? You know, is blood more important here, ethnicity more important than religion? And in this case, religion is more important than ethnicity. The Kurds are Muslims. They are Sunni Muslims. And for many of the Kurds, the call of fundamentalist Sunni Islam is far more important than their ethnicity, which is why Kurds are killing Kurds in this war as well. We have Jim having called in from Iowa, who has a question on anointing. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Yara. I was studying some things about anointing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading in Richard's site, Power on High.
Yeah.
He talks about...
That's Frank's site, is Power on High. Richard's site says blessyahuwah.com.
Okay, yeah. I'm getting mixed up.
Okay.
Jeremiah 10:27, he talks about the anointing oil.
Mm-hmm.
Are we still doing that today?
No. No. First of all, there is this presumption that there is a link between anointing and the Messiah, as if he is the Messiah, based upon the Hebrew Messiah. And it's interesting that nowhere in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms is Messiah written HaMashiach, or is it so there is no the anointed or the Messiah, the Messiah. Never used once as a title. And the time that it's actually written in prophecy, the only time that it's written in prophecy and speaks of the coming of the Messiah, which I actually think is Maaseiah, which is the work of Yahweh. It's written as an adjective modifying the noun messenger. And so it's not used as a title at all, and it's most certainly not used as a name anywhere. Messiah is used as a name, but Messiah is not used as a name, and it's not used as a title. When it is modifying messenger in the two Daniel passages, the actual root of the word speaks of that which is set apart and prepared. So it's a messenger that is set apart and prepared. Yirmiyah was as a messenger set apart and prepared. The most important time where an individual is as masak is anointed, if you want to use that, is a religious connotation really of what masak means, because it means to set apart and prepare. The time that it's done, that's spoken about in great detail in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms is when Samuel is asked to Masiach, set apart and prepare a dote. Dote is the only person where God says, you know, that's my guy. I love him. And he is established not only as the king of Israel, but also as the model of the kingdom that is to come here on earth. This idea of the application, and it's quite a recipe of things that go into it. It's not just olive oil when the application is used, but it's and I've done the analysis within the last couple of 3 years of all the ingredients that were listed in the in this mixture, but it's all very symbolic kinds of things, you know, symbolic of being preserved, being set apart, being prepared, and of course olive oil, which is the medium of the mixture of ingredients, is symbolic of not only nurturing and healing, but also a pure light. So represents the set apart spirit. But no, we're not. Lots of reasons we're not. One is that Israel is no longer Torah observant. We're not in Israel. The only place that that God would have any say over who is king would be in Israel, and yet they're not listening to him. So there'd be no reason for us to do it. And there is no one that is a direct prophet of Yahweh today. So I don't see any reason to anoint.